And I would like to invite you to put questions or comments on the presentations you have seen or heard. Are there any direct questions or comments? So there was one lady, please.
My name is Anne Østergaard. I come from Denmark. My question is to Extremadura Project. I would like firstly to ask, did it have any rub-off effect to other regions in Spain, what was done in Extremadura? Because I have heard that it might have had some effects in Andalusia, but does it also spread to other regions in Spain? Yeah. And the second question is, does Spain have a competence center to give help to anybody who would like to switch from proprietary software to free software? And do you use in Spain the sources and the experiences which has been experienced in Germany? Because the Ministry of the Interior in Germany made this wonderful guide on how to migrate to free software. So these are my main questions. And also I would like to add that coming from a Scandinavian country, it is very, very difficult for us to try to spread the wonderful message because we cannot understand Spanish. And I'm sure that people in the far regions of the Nordic countries would love to share your experience.
Thank you. The first question, other communities in Extremadura are very interested in what we are doing. We have a cooperation contract with Andalusia to improve all the free software movement. They began to put also the computers with free software in the educational Andalus system. So we are in the way to cooperate with another region in Spain. Valencia is also interesting, Mallorca too, but not only in Spain, because we are cooperating, our project, Linux project, is cooperating with Brazil, with Porto Alegre, North Pas-de-Calais in France. We are giving all of our experience and all of our technological knowledge to all the region of Europe, South America, that want to cooperate with us and to increase the value of the free software projects. And the other question was?
I think the second question was, is there any coordinated or coordination institution for these open source strategies like for instance, in the government also, is a competence center for open source transforming processes in Spain?
In Extremadura, no. Not really. We are participating in a European project called eSafer with I think that the another 6 or 7 region in Europe, and we are going to transmit our experience. But we don't really have a competence center or similar to do it. We are traveling all day around Europe and South America to tell everybody what we are doing, but we don't really have a model of transmission or a way of transmission. But as I say you, we are open to collaborate with everybody. I say we are traveling everywhere because last Tuesday I was in Porto Alegre in South America, and now I'm here, and in 2 weeks I'm in Karlsruhe, and I'm only a small part of the project because we are a lot of people traveling around the world every day to tell everybody what is free software, which are the advantage of having free software in the society and the education.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I think this is a main question, how this sharing economy, how it, which is described in these presentations, is really taking place. I mean, the truth is concrete as ever. And I think considering that, for instance, 75%, as you said, of the IT industry in Germany is depending on Microsoft, it is also not to underestimate the convenience factor of this for the users. Also, we see it also in our institution, but I think everybody who is dealing with transforming the IT infrastructure has to deal with it. What Michael called the interoperability factor, you know, we have it in a way. In this monopoly structure, you have interoperability, but probably at a higher cost, as it should cost or could cost with a more open structure. But this is, I think, a factor. And I would like to ask Michael also how this interoperability in the monopoly structure probably can be changed into a more open structure, and which role, that would be my maybe second question, which role does the big industry playing in this field, like IBM or Sun or other companies?
Well, let me answer that question a couple of ways. One is that certainly the convenience of having a common operating system across 90% of all machines cannot be overlooked if that operating system works as advertised. And it cannot be overlooked if that operating system delivers the benefits of other aspects of the ecosystem. There is a wonderful report filed by the United Nations last year where the conclusion of one of the major chapters was, however, there has been no Moore's Law for software. While hardware prices continue to drop rapidly in price, the cost of software goes up, its reliability goes down, its security is suspect, and it's almost always more difficult to configure and maintain. Thus, the benefits of Moore's Law, you know, are not available to nations depending on traditional software. And so I, you know, sometimes I do think that if the dominant monopoly software did get two things right, if they did deliver instead of frustrate Moore's Law, and if it worked instead of not working, it would be, you know, all this free software stuff would just be theory. I misspoke. All this free software stuff would be focused exclusively on the moral and ethical foundations of the Free Software Foundation. And there would not be this secondary network of people who are trying to build more efficient and more effective systems. So I do think that it cannot be overlooked that there are these major forces, and it's my hypothesis that I've seen, whether working with the biggest companies or the entrepreneurs, that the people who can most effectively harness big forces, not 5% here and 10% there, but 100% every 2 years, or, you know, a factor of 1,000 or 1,000,000, those forces are the ones that change the world. And fortunately, the small forces also about why a developer might prefer to see source code than not also, you know, are working in our favor.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Could you please tell us a little bit about the role of the big industry like IBM, who really in the last years entered this field of free software development and marketing in a very rapid and massive way? How does it change your business model and the model?
There's no question that when IBM made their announcement that they were going to put $1 billion into Linux, people were thrilled. Nobody knew where IBM was going to put that $1 billion, but we were glad to know it was going to be put somewhere. Really, IBM has hundreds of thousands of employees, and one of the most important free software projects right now is, or at least open source projects, is the Eclipse.org developer project. I think that there are parts of IBM which are still learning about what this new world order means. There are other parts who have embraced it fully, but IBM provides a platform of 100,000 evangelists talking to decision makers, some of whom only listen to IBM. But being a big company does not mean that you always see the future and walk toward it. And I think Sun Microsystems has done a wonderful job of just showing how obtuse they can be, knowing full well the history of digital. And I think that the role that these large companies are playing is that they provide the potential for a great network effect. And I'll answer this really quickly and then move on. We have been accumulating total cost of ownership data from our customers, which somehow gets horribly, horribly perverted when it goes to analysts paid by Microsoft to analyze the data and publish it to the market. I don't know how that happens, but I do know that we are seeing customers saving tens of thousands of dollars per Unix to Linux migration migrated. Now, $10,000 may sound like a lot of money, but, and here's the role that Sun Microsystems plays, because they were so successful putting so many machines out there, when you multiply tens of thousands of dollars times the hundreds of thousands of enterprise licenses, support licenses that Red Hat has sold, that translates into billions of dollars of savings returned to the economy. So the role that these large companies do is they make the numbers interesting and world-changing, and the role that we, Wizards of OS, and the free software community play is to actually give direction to that change.
Thank you. Last question, please.
I would like to ask you a question on IBM especially, and this kind of dual policy of theirs. On one hand, supporting very forcefully open source free software. On the other hand, as we learn from other areas, that they are also very heavily lobbying for software patents now in Europe. How do you explain that?
Well, I wish I could explain it. I can explain it from Red Hat's perspective. We've decided to be a 100% open source company. We have looked at the two alternatives, and we say to ourselves, why waste our time pursuing policies that are part of the past instead of potential of the future? If you want IBM to explain how they draw that line and, you know, which side they choose to walk, IBM could answer it. But I can tell you that the people who have chosen to walk in the open source line and in the free software line at IBM, those guys are every bit as valuable as people who work for us, people who work in free software for our competition, and people who are completely unaffiliated, doing good stuff as well. But I think that to the extent that IBM can internally pull more people to fight the idiocy of the U.S. patent system and can encourage more people to be more forthright about what is a legitimate standard and how can that standard be protected from patents, the better.
Thank you.
What makes Red Hat successful? And actually, I think I know the answer to that question, and I'm proud to say I didn't figure it out. Eric von Hippel is the person who has sort of become the lead guru on user-driven innovation, which touches many of the points that Rishab makes. But it puts it in a framework that explains, I think, the real value engine. And there's no question that users who participate, as Rishab illustrated, feel personal benefit from the way they participate in user-driven innovation. But I think when you add it all the way up, it's not about the bits, and it's not about copying Model X or copying Model Y or copying Model Z. It's about being able to truly affect value delivery, and user-driven innovation is a way of unlocking tremendous potential. And the good news for companies who have customers is that user-driven innovation is waiting to happen. The bad news for startups who want to initiate with no customers, that engine isn't turning until customers happen. So my advice to your region is, rather than trying to get hundreds of companies all practicing this art, try to get one company or two companies who can actually develop that positive, the jet engine thrust of open source, and then start copying that if you're not already.
Well,
We are trying too. We don't really know what which is the model we are going to have. Hundreds of small companies developing software or giving services around software application, or two big companies making sure the model and stable. We don't really know. What we know now, and this is very important, is that we have an opportunity. 2 years ago, technological companies in Extremadura were bored, were fed up of everything, and they were I don't know how to say fontaneros, always repairing and repairing the system. Now they have an opportunity to create software. They have an opportunity to update. They have an opportunity to adapt to another company. So now they are happy, and they can see the opportunity, and they are going to take. And this is thanks God to the free software. And we don't know what the future would be, but I hope it will be better than 2 years ago.
I'd like to add to that also, using since we are not, doesn't look like we're going to see the video, I was in Extremadura a month ago and I visited some of the schools. And the thing about skills development is, of course, that it takes a long time before skills have been acquired and those skills translate into economic activity. So while Julio might talk of just 10 or 15 companies being set up, the fact is there are 80,000 computers with Linux being made available to school children, so that's about 150,000 school children. What I think we're going to see in the video is that 80,000 people who are pensioners, unemployed, and so on, have been given training in using computers for the first time, and their first impression has been with GNU Linux. And what happens is that we don't know how many hundreds of companies can get started up through this access and widespread of skills going through society. And a related point is, of course, that when so many people are able to access and use software that is free software, it clearly shows that there's no usability disadvantage. It's not hard to use Linux, because if pensioners and school children who've never used computers before can do it, then it's obviously not a difficult thing to do.
It's very important, but because when the people who is now in the school, and they are learning how to use Linux and how to use Linux, and they are going to arrive to the job market in 5 or 6 years, and they are going to the company, and they are going to ask for how to use Linux, and they are going to say to the director of the company, to the manager of the company, well, I know how to use Linux, I know which are the advantages of Linux, and why don't we use Linux? So the people who is now in the high school, in the school, the big revolution is going to be when we will be in the job market.
I think this relates quite well to the presentation also of Rishab, that there is a transfer of skills which is part of this free software economy. Rishab describes it more as as a big part of it is an informal skill. I think I would say that it could be also a political task to develop formal procedures of sharing. For instance, if the experiences from Extremadura, as the lady from Scandinavia put it, could be very worthwhile for regions otherwhere in Europe or in the world. But how to learn how to share this experience? And I think it's not possible, or it's too complex, the whole field of all these projects, that you can say, okay, people should just look after it. I think especially in Europe with this multilingual situation, you know, you can't see, if you can't read Spanish, you won't get it so fast. And therefore, I think that it could be a political task to invent infrastructures or procedures to foster this sharing of knowledge.
Well, that is being done at least at the European level. The European Commission's e-government program has strong support for open source. Well, now the term within the EC is open source, so that's what they use. And there is also the IDEA, which is supposed to coordinate interaction between governments. And they've set up, as I said, the Open Source Observatory, which is going to be a clearinghouse of information and experiences and case studies of different public administrations, how they use it. Of course, this is mainly focused on the public administrations. They've organized a number of workshops for public administrators to share experiences on open source policy and implementations. There's one going to take place in 2 weeks from now in Karlsruhe during Linux Tag. And we are going to do a conference along with the Dutch presidency of the European Union in The Hague in November 18th on similar topics. So there is a lot of activity in terms of the public sector using free software, at least. But for the private sector or society at large, of course, that requires initiatives from the private sector.
Thanks a lot. I think it's a start. But I was also 3 weeks ago in a conference in Brussels, you know, where the experience was that a lot of cities or regions are working on the same problem without knowing each other. So it's a process which started, which is still to be developed, I think. And I mean, in some respects, Germany is still a developing country in this area, because I mean, my daughter is now 11 and gets informatics, and I was wondering what she's getting, and she's getting to learn how to use Microsoft Word. So this is still, this is maybe like 20 years ago, it would be an advantage, but now I think in comparison to the Extremadura, this could be a disadvantage, and it takes a while until this is trickled down into the institutional field of education, also of public administration, I think. But I think what we could take out of this panel is that if there's a concise strategy, and if there's also a business model which is strategically good positioned, then the economic theory is proven, and therefore I think it is no riddle anymore, and there's no wonder why free software is also in the economic field, or could be also in some years, and it is until now, and I think it will be also in the future a success story. Thank you, Michael. We have a question. Oh, wow. I was my final words motivating you for our final question. Okay, please.
Okay, hi. My name is Emil Afram, and I'm a free software hacker. I like to program computers, so that's what I do, and I also think that software should be free, geologically. So I try to release them as free software. Those are two things that defines me, and a third thing that defines me is that I also like to eat, because if I don't eat, then I die. So I try to combine these three things, and I find that very, very difficult. And this is supposed to be a panel on free software economics, and so far I haven't really been encouraged. Red Hat, although a success story, doesn't really encourage me, because Red Hat sells services, and I'm not interested in selling services. When I talked to Mr. Stallman a couple of years ago, he lifted up Cygnus Solutions as one example of a free software company, a successful one, but he doesn't anymore because it's now Red Hat. So my question is, selling free software is very, very difficult, because of course you can sell the first copy, but after that then the consumer can just give that copy away to everyone else, and that's of course a clear disadvantage to me as a company trying to sell free software. So, in conclusion, my question is, what insights do you have as a small ISV, independent software vendor, that wishes to remain so. I do not wish to sell services. I do not wish to provide consulting or administration of Unix boxes. That's not what I'd like to do. I'd like to produce and sell free software. How would I go about that?
Okay. It's easy. The magic word is consulting. Consulting. Make sure, for example, I can...
He doesn't want to consult. He wants to sell software.
Exactly.
He wants to sell software. Yes, but you can sell it by consulting. So I'm going to explain. For example, with Factor Linux. Factor Linux is the management tool, GPL, 100% freedom. And we have one company in Extremadura developing Factor Linux. Make sure that your software is good, that it's going to be used for the companies, and you can sell consulting to the other companies that they are going to sell services. I don't know if you can understand me. So you can continue creating, updating, and making better your program, and you can give to the other that they are going to sell services to the final client. This is the way that we are managing in Extremadura. So we have another technological company creating the software. So makes good tools, free tools, and make you a consultancy of the technological company that are going to give services. This is the way, I think. It's a new business model.
I would say you're describing a kind of supply side economics. There's something you'd like to do that you'd like to get paid for, and it's based on a supply side. And a lot of what I did talk about, and a lot of what I would talk about if I had an hour and a half instead of 30 minutes, is basically how Red Hat has reconceived ways of doing business based on the incredible demand side, you know, the demand of companies to save billions of dollars, the demand of companies to get back onto Moore's Law, and meeting that demand. And gosh, you do have to change what you supply to meet demand, because the demand is so big you can't necessarily fit it in a simple way. But with that being said, I do think, I don't know if you're familiar with The Company, and I don't know whether you would consider them to be consultants or programmers. I consider them to be a programming company who basically says, we'll write something really cool, and you just give us a date and you give us a time, and you know, we'll create an application, we'll create a project manager for you, we'll integrate some calendaring system, we'll, you know, hack some new KDE widgets. And I don't know if that's the model you're looking for, but I don't think of them as consultants. I think of them as hackers writing free software, and they have had a relationship with Red Hat that I think has been good for both of us. As an example,
you have another possibility. If you can program, you can come to Extremadura, and I give you a job.
Well, sure. I wanted to point out, when I gave a keynote at Linux Congress in 1999, and that was before IBM was putting billions of dollars, and most of the people in the audience were Linux kernel developers. And what was nice for me was that they agreed with everything I said, which, of course, when you come up with a hypothesis, is nice to see that your subjects believe it's true. And none of them were, most of them, of course, being Linux kernel developers, had to spend their time programming and not really doing services. But what were they doing for a living was, in effect, well, consulting in a sense, but writing programs for clients, but telling those clients that, well, these are going to be free software programs. And the clients didn't object, because the clients wanted the program to meet their needs, and after that, if it was also going to their competitors, it didn't matter. The clients are not going to sell it to their competition. So you can sell the same thing over and over again, even though it's free software, because your clients are not selling it to each other, because each of them has slightly different needs. And those slightly different needs are what you're able to charge much more for, because you're charging for the whole package, even though you might make small changes. Because they don't have the skills to make those small changes, and they don't have the interest. They're interested in hiring you to do that. But it depends on what software you're doing, of course.
Okay. Thank you. I think it was important to raise this critical question. I think the free software market is not an automatic success story. I think that is clear. We have seen a lot of failures. But on the other side, as you have seen in the region of Extremadura, the demand side has to be developed. And as far as it is concerning for the public administration sector, this is a political task to develop a concise IT strategy. And the beginning is made in Europe, as we've heard, but also the supply side will be developed. I mean, that is probably your difficult situation will not be solved automatically, but if the development, as we have seen it in the last years, is going on, then probably also you have your possibility to supply more goods than at the moment. So I think Michael Thiemann, Rishab Ayagosh, Julio Juste, is it working? So final, we have like 2 minutes or so? Yeah?
No, it's too long. It's 7 minutes.
So. Oh, 7 minutes. So we won't have 7 minutes, but probably we can have we can start it, and then we will say farewell. And the during this minutes, the next panel can construct here. So thank you, Michael Thiemann, Richard Ayagosh, and Julio Juste. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.